Hello, I'm Alan Kohler, Editor-in-Chief of Eureka Report, and welcome to Money Cafe. And joining me today is Luke McGregor, the writer, actor, comedian, and economist. And we're in the Money Cafe. G'day, Luke. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, Alan. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Well, we are remote, of course, not actually in the cafe, but there you are. That's life in lockdown and in COVID. But
The producer will add some cafe sound effects in the background before this goes up. And
yeah, well, that's entirely possible. but maybe one day we'll do it in the cafe, Luke. That'll be good. So tell us a bit about yourself before we get into the topics of the day. You did a Bachelor of Economics at University of Tasmania. Why did you? And you, I think you did some work as a business analyst for a while. Why did you switch to being a comedian and actor?
I did try back in the day when I was working in superannuation. I did try and put some jokes into my presentations. I remember once I was doing a presentation to, I think it was Australian Super, and I tried to do a joke where this was during the financial crisis and how the returns of, been going down, but if you turn the graph upside down, we're actually looking really good. And to do that, you have to actually flip and invert the graph. So when I turned it upside down, it was just pointing down the opposite way. Anyway, I bombed. I just decided to go more direct comedy rather than trying to incorporate it into my economics knowledge.
Yes, never look back. Really, I mean, you've had a fantastic career, I think, and we've loved you in Rosehaven.
Oh, thank you. That's definitely the public perception I try and put across anyway. It's been good. I've been really fortunate. I still love spreadsheets and I still love economics, so it's nice to I try and keep up with the news, but it's mostly trying to come up with the jokes about Tassie real estate lately.
Yes. Well, we'll get on to real estate in a moment, but I thought it'd be a good idea to just start with, speaking of economics, start with the intergenerational report that came out this week from Treasury that was launched by the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg. And one of the things it kind of showed was that there'll never be a surplus. Basically, it showed, and it's really the first time, I think, that any government has ever predicted that their budget will never be in surplus. It'll always be deficit. And then, in fact, in 40 years' time, according to this report, the budget in 2061 will still be getting wider. So you did a fantastic explanation of modern monetary theory on Charlie Pickering's show. What was it called? Is it The Project?
Oh, The Weekly.
The Weekly, yeah. There was, I think there was a while ago. But and I wonder, do you reckon that this is modern monetary theory now in – at work?
I think so. I mean, modern monetary theory is always I always wonder if they should take the theory out of it, because it does feel like it's just sort of explaining how things are currently working. Anyone listening who's not familiar, modern monetary theory is basically the idea that a country that can issue its own currency, like Australia, America, Japan, doesn't have any limits to government spending. There are consequences to spending, but no limits. Basically, a simplified idea, I guess, is if you've got a printer that can print money, obviously you're not going to be worried about what debt you've got to pay back. Just that money has value. This was huge. I thought this was big, because debt's often thrown around in politics as kind of like you're spending too much. But I think both parties are coming to realize now that, you know, we can't tighten the strings here. We have to spend to stimulate the economy, and it's almost like it's acknowledging the power they've always had, which is, you know, the power to issue currency.
One of the things you said in that little segment on that show was that the government spends money into existence, which I thought was a terrific way to put it. Just flesh that out. Explain it to us.
Yeah, so I always think of it in terms of Medicare. And I actually rang the Reserve Bank about this just to double check. But basically, if let's say Medicare has a certain amount of budget allotted to it, and then, you know, a critical mass of people went to the GP and spent more than that was allocated to Medicare, your Medicare rebate would never bounce. The whenever the government spends money, it's creating that money. So taxes essentially delete money from the economy, and government spending puts money back in. But it's not as if there's a bank account full of taxpayer dollars that the government draws from.
I think that's the thing that people don't really understand, that they regard the government as a kind of a household or a company where you make revenue and then you spend the money that you get in. But in fact, as you point out, what the government spends is actually created at the time it spends it.
Yeah, sometimes I think it helps to think of it like if you were to start a new country and you wanted to spend, and you wanted people that living in your country to spend your money that you invented, you'd need to spend it and give it to the people in your country first. So if I made Luke bucks, I'd have to actually pay people in Luke dollars before I could start taxing them back Luke bucks. So it's the government spending that's creating the money, and the taxes is just deleting it, not the other way around. You have to spend first before you can even, tax that currency back.
And the tax and the taxation also creates a demand for the currency, which wouldn't otherwise be there.
Exactly. We can't spend US dollars in Australia. We have to use the Australian currency, which is why taxes are really important, because without taxes we wouldn't have to use the Australian dollar, in which case the power of the government to issue currency to create money, they wouldn't have it because we wouldn't be using it. So it's part of what makes
El Salvador's decision to make Bitcoin legal tender quite interesting, because presumably that means you can pay your taxes in El Salvador with Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It's essentially just taking away one of the tools the government has, I guess, to influence the economy. Assuming you can change the currency for a Bitcoin, so you can still use the power of your being able to issue currency. But yeah, it's an interesting one. I think it's something that every country will have to deal with, I suppose, as cryptocurrencies become more and more mainstream. If that ever happens, I assume it will eventually.
While we're talking about Bitcoin, what do you think of that? Have you been a crypto investor at all?
Yeah, I used to own Bitcoin, Ethereum, and I think I've still got some Litecoin just because I forgot that I had some. I went in on the first sort of mass wave of it, and then I put maybe 3% of my savings at the time just into various cryptos, and then just thought I'll just sit on them for 20 years and see what happens. I've never really been into the sort of the more day trading aspect of it, or the highs and lows. I just sort of thought I'll just buy a few and then set and forget, see what happens. So,
and did you set and forget, or did you get rid of them?
I got rid of Bitcoin during the last bump up and Ethereum, but I'll probably buy back in at some point. I don't know if you've heard about what's that token that's supposed to be. There's one of them for, it's supposed to be tied to the US dollar.
Tether,
yeah. That's about to go under some sort of collapse. I'm scared to go back in until that happens, if that happens.
Yeah, there's a few. The Tether's the main one. There's a few what are called stable coins that are linked to fiat currencies.
It feels like Tether's on a bit of a spiral, but I can't confirm that. Some of the people I follow, but basically I've got no idea, and I've just got some set and forget.
Well, let's talk about the other Ponzi scheme called housing, shall we?
Yeah.
So the house prices are up again. It's the ninth month in a row of rising house prices. What's your view about all this?
Yeah, housing prices are a funny one. I feel like until there's some real sort of changes to federal policy, they'll continue to rise. Some changes to negative gearing or anything to sort of bring the overall price down. But it's one of those things where, if you own property, I recently bought an apartment. I can speak from my own experience that you never want that place to go down in value. At the same time, you want people to be able to buy a house who are just entering the market. And it feels like in Australia, there's a lot of policies set up so benefits investors, like negative gearing especially, is something I benefit from, but it certainly wouldn't help me. It certainly isn't helping new home buyers. And Labor tried to do it with the last election, but at some point it's going to have to be like an unpopular decision, I feel, to say, okay, we're going to eliminate negative gearing for all future investment properties. And unless you're buying a house to live in, you're not going to get these tax rebates. I don't know. I don't know. It seems like it'll always be unpopular because, if you own a house, you don't want it to go down. And if you... but the only way for housing to be more affordable is for it to go down.
So the prices for Sydney, I've got it now. So the prices for Sydney up 2.6% for the month, 15% for the year. So the financial year for the country, the national median was 13.5% increase for the year. That's pretty fancy when you think about it. I mean,
yeah. It's also interesting that there was something in the budget they announced with for helping single parents or single there was some sort of grant or I can't remember exactly, but anything like the first home buyers grant or any policy that's similar to it still doesn't sort of address the problem, which is I always think about it like if you've got, say, three people at an auction, you've got an investor, a first home buyer, and maybe an overseas investor. Like if you give someone the first home buyer's rebate, all you're doing is putting someone, you're just increasing their purchasing power, but you're not actually affecting the price of housing. If anything, that's a demand stimulus, so you'll increase the price of housing.
Exactly, that's right.
I feel like until the policy puts in place that is actually going to reduce it in some way, because the only way to really reduce the price of houses is to reduce the demand for them, which means either building more or Thanos snapping half the population out of existence. So it just feels like a lot of it's getting addressed.
One of the causes of demand in recent years has been high levels of immigration, which is now finished. Mm. So that'll lead to a decline in demand eventually, you would imagine. It hasn't happened, seemed to have happened yet. But the other thing is that they need to increase supply, I would think. I mean,
exactly. It's just supply. And, when people say house prices going down, it almost feels like it's, outside of human control. But really, it means someone selling their house has to decide they're going to sell their house for less. And that's a really hard decision to make. And a lot of people don't want to do that. So there's really going to be quite a lag before people, admit to, and both my parents are real estate agents, and one of the hardest things to do is convince a buyer to accept less than they want. So it's a seller, sorry. So it takes a lot for house prices to go down, we address different economic.
And even in recessions, they don't go down that much. We don't have in Australia, at least we haven't had big crashes. I mean, America, in the financial crisis, when you'd just finished your economics degree, the financial crisis saw American house prices fall by a third. We've never had that in Australia.
Yeah, and unless people have a real need to move, I personally would just, if I didn't have to sell for any reason, I'd just hang on and wait for the market to go back up, because that's when people want to sell. So they're really hard to bring down in Australia, and it's I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what's going to change other than the government or encouraging new builds to increase the supply.
You also wanted to talk about political donations, I think, Luke, and you want to ban them. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was. This is something that came up when I was on Q&A, but I just thought about how there's these sort of large corporate interests that are able to contribute large amounts to government to politicians, and how that sort of benefits the average person, and whether we'd have a better system if political donations were gone. So they weren't serving any particular interest, but I don't quite know how the new system would work, because I believe that Liberal and Labor get around 11.2 million in public money to fund their campaigns as well as on top of whatever political donations they get. But I don't know what a party like the Fishers and Shooters Party or the Sex Party, I don't know what level of funding they get and
it has to
how,
do,
the, I think, how a new process would work. I would like to think at a minimum we should have completely transparent political donations, so everything has to be declared. I think at the moment donations less than is it 10 grand or there's a point which you don't have to declare it, and I feel like that doesn't, having lack of transparency in politics doesn't really gain us anything. But it's a tricky one. I don't know. I almost want to run for office and then just whatever. Like, let's say if I was running for Liberal or Labor, I'd say whatever. If I was running for Labor, I'd just say, okay, whatever Liberal's doing, we're going to do all the same policies, but we're going to make political donations transparent. But otherwise, a vote for us is a vote for Liberal. like just run the exact same campaign, but just to get rid of political, make political donations transparent. It just feels like a no-brainer to me.
Me too. I agree, Luke. Yeah. And I think I think the amount of money you get depends on your vote. I think that I think there's a threshold below which you don't get any money, and then I think it increases according to how much of the vote you get. But so the Liberals and the Liberal Party and the Labor Party get the most money, of course, but that should be enough, and then we wouldn't get bombarded with so many ads. And they wouldn't be beholden to vested interests in the same way that they are.
Exactly. It almost feels like politics right now, and this is really cynical of me, but it does feel like politics is convincing us to think that the special interests they're serving benefit us as opposed to trying to benefit us. I think we see that in, energy policy, public spending, the different, changes to government red tape around corporations. I just feel like all of it's there to serve the interests of the donators and not the people who voted for them.
I don't think Australia's energy policy debacle is entirely a result of political donations, but I reckon it's been part of it. I mean, the fossil fuel companies have donated a lot of money to the coalition, and we've seen the result of that. But I do think also the coalition is inclined to, or has been inclined to, take the opposite policy to the Greens and the Labor Party simply because they need to differentiate themselves.
I think you're right. Yeah, like if they have to take an alternate stance. It's a funny one. I mean, really, it just comes down to people's power bills being cheaper. But I guess what irritates me is that a lot of the with the coalition, you'll read about these groups they put together to sort of give them advice, and then they don't listen to it. It's especially around the gas spending. They were just obsessed with gas, even though the amount of power was, I think they said they needed 1,000 megawatts when it was only 154 megawatts, according to the kilowatt. Apologies, my knowledge of energy measurements isn't great, but it was, basically, they just needed an alternate dispatchable power source, and you'd think you just look for the cheapest, but they didn't. It was,
And they're going to build a gas power station. The government is. I mean, goodness me.
Exactly, and they're so. I always thought with Liberal they're sort of all about the free market, but the market said that a gas fired power station wasn't feasible from a private enterprise point of view, so they subsidized it. That's not letting the market decide. That's choosing to go with gas. So I don't know. It just never made any sense to me. And I really tried to think about it in terms of not worrying about the environment, just assuming the whole world can burn down. But is this cheaper? And it's not. It's not even cheaper. It doesn't. It just didn't make any sense to me. I have no idea why. Other than trying to serve some sort of interest that they need to, or I don't know, win votes in a certain electorate, I just don't understand the process, the thought process behind it.
I think it's the serve the interests of the National Party to some extent, but I think it can't be too long now before Scott Morrison actually commits Australia to net zero emissions by 2050. They've so far said preferably by 2050 and left that word in. But that word's got to go soon, I would think.
I assume so, because to me, the one of the things that I think will drive it will be our our export market, in that a lot of countries, as part of reaching their own zero emission targets, won't want to import from countries that are still on fossil fuel, or like import goods that are produced using fossil fuels, because that sort of negates their own work to get to zero. So Australia with their hydrogen production, you can do that with solar, or you can do that with coal. And I know I don't have it in front of me, but I believe China's making waves using renewable sources to make hydrogen dispatchable. And Australia doesn't do the same thing. We're going to sort of lose out to any market that does. So it's it just feels like we have to clean up our act, not for our own sake, but just because if we want to continue to export, we'll have to, because other countries will hold us to a different standard.
I think you're right, Luke, and I could talk to you all day, but we need to move on to the questions. So we've got a few questions. You ready for that?
I'm ready.
Okay, the first one's from Andy, and he says, just writing to say, enjoying the new podcast. It'd be great if we could hear some insights about the risks of starting to invest in the current stock and property markets as a young or youngish investor. It feels like it's a massive bubble of assets everywhere. Inflation is around the corner, basically very risky, very keen to get into the indexing game, but reluctant to lose. Anyway, a bit of context. I'm 30, married, own a principal place of residence with my wife, 30% plus equity now, lucky to have a fairly good super balance, a secure public sector job. Now, listen, Andy, we can't give personal advice, so this is general advice only.
It's also tough because no one really knows what the market's going to do. So if we knew, we'd be doing it ourselves.
Exactly. That's right.
The one thing I still to Andy, I guess, is something I think about when I'm personally thinking about any investment is when I need the money back out. Like if you're, say, if you want to invest, say, 50% of your wealth into, your average sort of share, let's say with your super, like you want to put it in the, I think they call them basic funds or your standard, as opposed to, say, in cash or more risky stuff, then it kind of depends on when you have to take your money out. Like if you're going to set something in as an investment until you're 65 and not going to touch it, then sort of whatever the market's doing right now doesn't matter too much, because I think the average growth of the share market is, what 12% a year, or what is
it? A bit less than that, but yeah.
Less than that. But, yeah, it sort of depends on when you'll need that cash. If you're going to need to spend big in the next, couple of years, or you're going to want to buy a new house, or you're going to need the money for something in the next year and you need your assets to be fairly liquid, then, that's sort of – I think about – because, no one really knows what the market's going to do. When I make my own decisions, I try and think about when will I need this amount of money in the near future, and if it is something I can afford to sit in a on a share for 20 years, that's a different decision than if I'll have to take it out in a year and then deciding what to put that money into.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that's fantastic advice. And someone who's 30, it depends. I mean, with his super, he's got $150,000 in super. I mean, that's presumably there until he's 65 or something, and in which case he doesn't have to worry about anything much. He just leaves it
there.
Yeah,
like if he's Alan, you go.
No, if he's investing for another amount for a shorter time period, he needs to keep that a bit more defensive.
Yeah, I try and break it into buckets and think about what percentage of money am I willing to lose for a high gain, and then just take a punt, knowing that you could lose it all. But as far as long term decisions go, if you put 150K in your super, and then when you retire at 65, 35 years later you retire and it's worth less, then I'd say the world's in more trouble than like you. There's probably some bigger problems happening on Earth if that's the case.
Yes, that's right. Okay, next question is from Miles. Best wishes for the new Money Cafe project. Thank you, Miles. I hold a percentage of my super in a conservative option with UniSuper. This option allocates 70% to cash and bonds. I've held this position for several years but not added anything to it since 2019. I get it that buying bonds is not currently the currently not a good idea, and their role as a hedge against drops in the market has diminished. My question is, if you have held bonds in your portfolio for some years, should I just stick with it, or should I be looking to move this investment elsewhere in my super portfolio? I'm almost 60. Oh, right. Well, crikey. I don't think bonds are a good idea at the moment because interest rates are only going up from here, probably, which means the value of the bonds is going to go down.
Yeah, it's a tricky one too, because when you move from one investment to another, you know, you're leaving that investment at that price and you're joining the new one at a new price. So it sort of depends on how much value for money you get, depends on kind of when you swap over. So it's because if he's 60, I'm assuming he'll want to take it out fairly soon. But it's I guess it's just whatever he feels is worth the, you know, you could say move from bonds, which are, you know, generally considered more safe, and into, say, a more volatile investment, and then hypothetically in 5 years' time when you take it out, it could be worth less if there's some sort of crash. It's just risk versus reward, basically. Like, is there a certain money target you're really wanting to hit? And if that's the case, like if not knowing what Alan's goal is, if Alan has a goal of a certain amount of money he really wants to hit, and then what steps does he need to take to hit that? And is his current investment strategy going to get in there? Right, it's a really tricky one. These questions are really hard to answer because you can't really give any advice.
No, we can't. We don't know enough about them.
Honestly, I don't know myself. I don't even know what I'd tell my dad if he asked me this question. It's a tricky.
No, just a general statement. It would be that bonds are not. I mean, bonds have been not a bad investment over the last sort of 10 years because yields, you know, bond interest rates have come down, prices have gone up, so it hasn't been stupid. But from now on, I think it's the other way around. Just in, you know, as a sort of general comment about bonds.
Yeah, it does feel like they're certainly not. Well, they certainly didn't have the value they had before when he probably initially put in his investment anyway.
Got another question here from Adric. I've been interested in space companies that are listing, Rocket Lab NZ and Astra US. Both these companies are listing on the NASDAQ, not using IPO, but using something called a special purpose acquisition company. What is this and how is it different from a normal IPO? Well, we don't have these here. They're called SPACs, S-P-A-Cs, special purpose acquisition companies, and they were set up. There've been a whole lot of them. I can't remember how many exactly, but there's been billions of dollars poured into these SPACs in the US, and they're basically cash boxes. People have put money into these companies. They themselves have IPO'd, and their purpose in life, they say, is to use the money to buy something. So,
Rocket Lab, I'm assuming right now, doesn't have any rockets or do anything. It's essentially just a name with a bunch of money, and they'll try and buy something, which I assume they'll hope will make money later, right? It's basically just someone saying, give us money now, and then we'll hopefully buy something later or acquire something later that will make us money. Is that kind of how they work?
That's sort of how these SPACs work. I mean, I don't know anything about Rocket Lab or Astra. As to whether they've got any activities at all, or they're just a bunch of box of cash, I just don't know.
Okay, don't they have to give the money back after a certain period of time if they don't use it? I don't know.
Yeah, it depends on the constitution of each business, people have been perfectly happy to pour money into these things, here we do what's called backdoor listings, where companies that want to go onto the ASX, they'll be taken over by a company that's got nothing but cash in it or not much in the way of activities at all, and they just get onto the stock market that way instead of doing an IPO. So there's two ways to do it here, and likewise in the US, it's just that the SPACs are something that's unique not only to the US but to this time.
Yeah, I'd say that from my own personal point of view, I'd be more interested in the people that are behind the SPAC as opposed to, say, if I really believed in sort of space as an industry, I'd be more in this instance, because it's just them acquiring capital, I'd be more interested in just sort of looking at who is running these and do I trust them? As opposed to the trying to invest in space, you know, existing in a, you know, an already established company. I don't know how many space companies there are that you can invest in right now, but you know, if NASA let me buy shares in them, I'd definitely do it.
I don't think I'd touch any of these with a satellite.
Yes. I mean, I'm a big Star Trek fan, so maybe I'm biased.
Oh yeah, okay. Well, we could say we wouldn't touch it with a laser sword. Is that what they're called?
That is not what they're called at all. it's a lightsaber, but it's
a lightsaber. Yes,
and that's Star Wars. But you've really
I've really bucked it up. Yes. What do they have in Star Trek?
Star Trek, they've got phasers, phasers to stun.
Yes.
But I like both, so I'll take all. If a company starts creating real laser swords, I'll definitely invest. I'll be the first one.
They've been slapping the Star Wars logo on everything these days. There's so many Star Wars things going on, as far as I can tell. It's crazy. I assume
there's a fair bit of money to be made.
Yeah.
But I've never stopped being a fan. I thought as I got older, I'd be more into more mature things. But no, if anything, I just buy more toys.
Hey, just on that subject, we need to get on to the final question in a moment. Did you ever read when you were young, Isaac Asimov's Foundation series?
I did read Isaac Asimov. I'm not sure if I read the Foundation series. Was that I read a series of his short stories?
Now apparently they made a film. A series of the Foundation series, which I'm really keenly looking forward to.
Oh, right, I'll have to have a look. Is it supposed to be good?
They were great books. I remember I read them as a teenager, and they've never made a film out of them.
It was great. I remember he had one where it was just a really simple story about the sun going out, and then. You know, this society that had either grown up without light or grown up without darkness. I can't remember. I think it would grown up without darkness. It was brilliant. It was just these really simple premises that were really, really cool.
Final questions from Carolyn. I've been looking at Vanguard's personal investor product as a simple and low-cost vehicle for my young adult children to get started with investing in ETFs, managed funds, and equities. There are lots of things to like, such as zero brokerage on ETF trades, but deep in the PDS, I've come across I'm delighted, Carolyn, that you've got deep into the PDS for a start. I think it's great because most people don't. I've come across details of the ownership of the assets. While an investor has beneficial ownership of the assets, Vanguard and subcustodian JP Morgan are the legal owners. Am I right to be concerned about this? What are the risks? Okay, what do you think? Do you know about this, Luke?
I think I've got shares in Vanguard. I don't actually know I don't understand where it said Vanguard and subcustodian JP Morgan are legal owners. I don't actually understand
means. They're custodians.
So does that mean you're giving them your money to do with what they please, but you don't actually own any of the stuff they invest in? Is that what it means? Or?
Well, in a strict legal sense, that's correct. Vanguard and JP Morgan are custodians. So right. Vanguard's custodian and JP Morgan is sub-custodian, but Carolyn would be the beneficial owner of the assets. It's fine. I don't think you need to be worried about it, Carolyn, because, I mean, it would be different if, you know, we were talking about fly-by-nights, small companies that might go broke, in which case, you know, you might be scrambling around trying to get hold of your assets, but in this case, Vanguard and JP Morgan are two of the biggest companies in the world, so they're fine.
And I don't know whether their actions would, like, if you were the direct owner as opposed to sort of this, you know, them being a custodian. I don't see what the risk difference would be. I feel like it would be the same risk, right? Or it would be the
That's right.
It wouldn't actually affect what they're doing. They'd still make the same decisions.
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine, Carolyn. Don't worry.
Good on you for reading the PDF.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's unusual and fantastic. So well done for that. And that's it, Luke. Well, geez, it's been great. Really enjoyed talking to you today, and I hope to catch up with you in an actual cafe sometime.
That would be great. Yeah, thanks, Alan. It's went too fast. I really enjoyed talking about that stuff. So thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no worries. And thanks, everyone, for listening to today's episode of Money Cafe. Now, if you've got any questions, send them in and we'll answer them next week. And next week's episode of Money Cafe is with Malcolm Turnbull, former Prime Minister. So if you've got any questions for him and me, send them to themoneycafe@eurekareport.com.au.
Just have a redhead comedian and then former Prime Minister on the next one. So it's quite a wide variety of guests.
Exactly. That's right. So until next week, I'm Alan Kohler, Editor-in-Chief at Eureka Report, and with me has been Luke McGregor, the writer, actor, comedian, and economist.